Coming up on this week's episode of TechSnap, a new type of Apache exploit hides in shared memory, making it very hard to find. We'll tell you all about this new type of intelligent malware, plus why all passwords are crackable no matter what anyone says, a great batch of your questions, and much, much more on this week's episode of TechSnap. Everyone, and welcome to TechSnap. This is episode 108, Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly systems network and administration podcast. We stream this episode live on May 2nd, 2013. This episode's brought to you by GoDaddy.com, and I'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. The live stream is powered by the incredible Scale Engine, which you should go check out at ScaleEngine.com. My name is Chris, and joining us every single week is our host, the admin, the tech, and the teacher, Mr. Alan Jude. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Chris, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.
108, dude, in a row. Yep. That's ridiculous. That is ridiculous. It's some kind of marathon.
It's a little bit ridiculous.
Yes. It is a little bit, yeah. You know, and it's getting warmer here in the studio. I don't know. This might be the last week of the jacket, Alan. I don't know for sure yet. Mm-hmm. I play it by ear. I thought it was going to be last week, but it's getting nice out in the Pacific Northwest, so watch out. I might be coming in for the next batch of episodes. I might be wearing my Hawaiian shirt or something.
Right.
And you've got your horns on, so you're set.
I don't know. Somebody said put them on, and I put them on and kind of forgot about them, so now you know, they're on.
So I was gifted some horns at Linux Fest Northwest this weekend.
Yes.
And I decided to wear them. I got a little bit of heat. It could have also been the FreeNAS shirt I was wearing at Linux Fest Northwest.
I'm just glad you were there representing the
good people. Well, Mr. Duke, guess what? Big show today. And yep. This first one, as somebody who has a few clients with Apache servers, that caught my attention. I actually haven't read anything about it yet, so I'm really glad you flagged this one.
Yep.
Sounds like it's a bad one, though. What's going on?
Yeah. So we talked about before an Apache infection called Deep Leech. That was a module that was being installed on people's Apache servers some way. They had never figured out how it was being installed.
Right.
But once it was there, it was pretty hard to detect and to get rid of. Because it would do things like hide from the administrator, right? It wouldn't. Basically, the goal of Deep Leech and the new one, the one we're talking about today, is called C-Dorked. I don't know where they get the name sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I wonder.
The goal there with both of those is to infect visitors with the black hole exploit kit. Basically, to infect their machines with a virus.
And the signature mark was how well it evaded from the admin, you know, being aware.
Right, like Deep Leech would be like, oh, the admin is logged in over SSH. I'm not going to try to affect anybody while he's here.
Right, very clever stuff.
And then once he goes away, goes back to doing the evil thing.
And remember, it would like set a cookie so it would know if you had been there before, and it would also generate new links in the iframe embed. Yeah.
Yeah. So the new one's called C-Dorked, and it's even more sophisticated.
Oh, boy.
And stealthy. It's unclear if C-Dorked is actually related to Deep Leech, because Deep Leech was an Apache module, whereas C-Dorked is actually an infected version of the binary, right? So they built it into the httpd executable itself.
Oh, nice.
Rather than as a module.
They maybe submitted a patch for that, huh?
And so it works quite a bit differently. But it shares the same goal of infecting users with the black hole exploit kit.
Right, of course.
And it uses a lot of the same kind of things to hide from the administrator. But it could have just been someone else who decided, hey, I can be that clever too.
Yeah,
you know, it's like you see a good idea and you borrow it. Right. That's how things evolve.
And let's be clear. I mean, Apache isn't the hardest thing to add a patch to.
No, and you know, basically, kernel APIs is fairly simple to, you know, a binary will work on almost any version of Linux, right? So you can pile it once and it'd work. Yeah. So unlike a lot of similar backdoors, C-Dorked does not store or modify any files on the file system other than the actual infected binary, right? So with Deep Leech, it was easy to tell if you were infected because there would be this extra module laying around, right? And that module would have a fingerprint and you could easily tell, hey, what's this, you know, and things like that. And it would have configuration and things like that, you know, symptoms you could look for. C-Dorked doesn't store anything on the file system. What it actually does is store state information and the configuration about the command and control servers to talk to and things like that are actually stored in shared memory.
Ah, clever.
You know, normally Apache uses some shared memory between all the HTTP processes to communicate and to, you know, store the config and all that stuff. So this makes about a 6 megabyte area of shared memory where it stores all the state about the virus itself and the configuration. And so when it gets commands from the command and control server, they actually come in the form of HTTP posts or gets to the web server that don't get logged, right? Because when basically when they catch the hook in the modified binary, they don't end up getting logged, so there's no trail that you receive this command from the command and control server. And basically the configuration gets stored in memory instead of on disk. And it also means that when an admin detects something is wrong, the steps they would normally take to try to fix it erase all the evidence about what actually happened.
So if you kill the process...
If you reboot all the... Yeah, you kill the process or reboot, all the configuration is gone.
Yeah.
If you, you know, lots of these things you're going to do, and you're not going to find a config file laying around.
Right. And honestly, if I thought my Apache server had been compromised, probably the first thing I would do is kill the service. I probably would make
sure... Stop the service before it continues to cause problems.
Yeah.
And then, oops, there, your shared memories... Not referenced anymore, deallocated, gone.
Yeah, wow.
Also, the region of shared memory has its permissions set wide open. So another process external to the Apache could read or modify the data. And actually, the people at ESET that discovered this wrote their own little tool to dump the information out of the shared memory.
Mm.
I have a link to it later in the article where... They can, you know, they have a little Python script which they've since rewritten as a C program that will detect whether you have this cdorked virus by basically looking for a shared memory segment that shares, you know, these certain aspects that make it look like cdork, right? So basically, if you have a shared memory segment that's 6 megabytes and attached to HTTPD, you probably likely have this infection. Also, all the bits that control the HTTPD, like all the virus-like bits that are in the HTTPD, the binary is actually encrypted with a static XOR key. So when it basically was designed to try to make it hard to tell that that's what was going on,
mm-hmm.
or to find, you know, common strings in the HTTPD, because they're all encrypted. Yeah, so all the instructions come as regular HTTP requests so that they're not going to trigger an intrusion detection system,
right.
Because
like
it's
normal,
a web server.
They
it's
look like normal traffic.
It's supposed to get requests on port 80.
Yeah.
Also, the backdoor has a reverse connection shell. So basically, the botmaster will connect to your server and send a special HTTP GET request that includes, you know, the IP address and port they want your server to connect to. Except for those are actually XORed as well, based on the IP address that's requesting the reverse connection.
Mm.
And it even has support for them to do that through a proxy so that, you know, they're not exposing their actual machine. But mostly what this does is normally when you set up, you know, you infected an Apache machine, you would set up, you know, a little listener on like some random port that would let you connect to it and get a shell, right? Going around SSH.
Sure.
But a lot of, especially bigger places or, you know, paranoid people will have firewall set up saying, you know, I didn't open that port, so don't let any connections in.
Mm.
So this uses a reverse connection. So basically it has Apache connect out to the attacker and where the attacker is listening on some port and receives the connection. Because most web servers are going to be set up to allow a connection out. Right? Or, you know, they could even set it up on port 80 so it doesn't look suspicious at all. It looks like, oh, right, that PHP script on our server had to connect out to some other IP address to pull an RSS feed or something.
I mean,
and meanwhile, what it's actually doing is...
How would you even be able to watch for that? Because it would... I mean, if your box normally goes out to the web...
Exactly. Right? So, basically doing all these things to make it appear like legit traffic instead of standing out obviously as, oh, look at this connection on port 1337. I bet that's legit. And
right.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Also, all of the communication across that reverse shell are XOR encrypted based on the IP address.
Mm.
So that an intrusion detection system isn't going to see commands flowing over in plain text. Right? Because that's a common thing with these. You know, if you're using Wireshark or something and you're looking inside the packets, you're not going to see, oh, look, here's the command he was running on my server because it's all encrypted.
Now, so in order to really do this, and this has actually kind of been something that's been a stumper, is like you still have to get on the box and replace Apache.
Yes, and they haven't figured out how they're doing that.
Yeah,
yet.
But it's happening like in mass amounts. I mean,
it's happening on a large scale. There's like 20 or 30,000 servers.
That's a pretty big number, right?
Right, but it's not quite epidemic or pandemic yet, right? It's not every Apache server getting compromised. So it definitely doesn't look like something in Apache itself, right? Because Apache does privilege separation.
Yeah, it'd be a lot more.
It appears like it, later in the article I mentioned, a researcher at Cisco thinks it might be related to Plesk, and either a vulnerability people haven't patched yet, or a zero day that there is no patch for. And that might explain that number, because Plesk is popular, but it's not as popular as cPanel.
Right.
Things like that.
And, you know, you get maybe one Plesk installation, you could get a whole bunch of Apache servers in one go, potentially.
Possibly, yep.
Hmm. Yeah, it does seem like there's probably something else that's getting you on the box. But whatever,
yes.
that could be a whole range.
SSH brute force, right? You know, a bunch of people saying, well, you know, at that scale, it might just be SSH brute force.
Yeah, yeah.
Although we would hope not. We hope people don't have an SSH user that can get root that's... BT in the chat room asks, how widespread is this? There's at least 20,000 servers that have this infection, apparently.
Jeez. Holy smokes. Well, any other thoughts on that?
As before, the goal of the backdoor is the same as the earlier version, to redirect users to visiting some legitimate site to the black hole exploit kit. Mostly what it does is it looks for JavaScript URLs. So when a user requests a JavaScript URL, it redirects them to the malicious code on some other website and delivers the black hole exploit kit.
Here's a kit for you.
The improved version does an even better job of hiding itself, right? But it's less obvious that it's happening, and it does all these things to hide from the administrator of the site or server. But also, it provides the perpetrators with additional analytics. Now, the URL that it redirects you to includes this really long base64 encoded string that has the domain you came from, the file you were trying to access, whether the file you were trying to access is JavaScript or not JavaScript.
Oh, you're killing me.
So it knows which infection to send you. So this allows the people that are running this virus to tell what websites are producing the most visitors and the most exploited users.
It just gets clever
also,
and clever.
They can tell when a website stops sending them visitors. Right? Oh. It's like we saw 1,000 visits a day from this website, and all of a sudden now it's zero.
That's a good metric to have.
Maybe they've updated their Apache.
Maybe
they
figured us out.
Them.
Right.
Or, yeah. Maybe they just upgraded Apache and we need to go re-exploit them. Or maybe they figured it out and we need to make sure we cover our tracks.
Yeah.
Or no to ignore any more stuff we get from that server because it might be them trying to spoof us or something.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. This has been really interesting to watch this evolve. This is
And like you said before, once a victim has been redirected to the exploit kit once, a cookie gets set on their system so they don't get sent it a second time.
Right.
So it's harder for them to figure out how they got it in the first place.
And is there a specific... We don't... No, there's not it's not a flaw in Apache as far as we know, so there's not really a patch
definitely
at this point. Yeah, that's what the chat room's asking. Yeah, geez, that's...
And then the other thing it does is it looks in the request, it looks in the referrer and things like that, and basically doesn't serve it up to any user that's gone to a URL that contains strings like admin, webmaster, submit, MRTG, webmin, cPanel, members, billing, host, secure, support, etc. So that way... if you're in the admin area of WordPress and then go to the front page because some user said, hey, I got a virus from your website, the virus doesn't get shown to you.
That's really like I said earlier, it really is just it's maybe just the beginning of a new kind of, I don't know if this is overstating it, but you think it could be possibly a new kind of malware that's just super clever, super intelligent, collecting analytics, self-adjusting, and I mean sounds like a step beyond what we've heard of before.
Not storing anything on the disk and, you know, having this reverse shell and trying to hide from the administrator are all very clever things.
Yeah. 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 I mean, some part of me is actually kind of impressed. I hope I never have to run into something like this. And can you imagine trying to explain this to a client? Oh, man.
Well, also just trying to figure out what's actually happening because you can't seem to get the virus shown to you. Right. It's not like I've seen exploits in the past where, you know, they modify a WordPress file to inject this iframe into every page.
Yeah.
So I can go to the website, see the iframe, and know what the problem is.
Exactly. Easy.
And then, but, yeah, in this case, it's a lot harder.
My client would have some questions, and I'd have a hard time answering them at first, especially if I didn't watch TechSnap, if I didn't know about this kind of thing. Then I'd really be up S-Creek.
So ESET, which is an antivirus vendor, has built a little script and has instructions on how to detect if you have this. So there's that. And they're asking if you could dump that shared memory area with their instructions and send it to them. Hmm. That would be helpful for them to try to, you know, if they get a bunch of different ones, they can try to figure out more of what's going on. Because in their article, they describe a couple other things they found that they haven't quite figured out what it's for yet.
Wow.
But it's still not clear how servers are actually getting infected with this, because you'd have to have root access to replace the HTTP, right? And, you know, some suggest that it's just SSH brute force, although one Cisco researcher says, you know, we see a lot of people still attempting attacks against an old Plesk vulnerability, and that suggests that it's working. So some people are still running old versions of Plesk. Right. And that's quite possible, because a lot of smaller type web hosts, like people that have a single server, it's generally like, oh, someone's like a web designer and they rent a server with a control panel like Plesk and then resell hosting to their clients. They're not really a server administrator. They don't know anything about Apache other than what they can click on in Plesk. Mm-hmm. And so people like that don't update Plesk.
The Mambo King's theory in the chat room is that it's Skynet and it's taken over by first compromising Apache and then spreading from there. There you go.
Right, except for I don't think Skynet would try to throw you the black hole exploit kit, which is just infecting your computer with viruses generally towards the end.
And
of
ads,
the
and Mafia. Skynet's got to raise funds. It's in the startup phase.
Russian Mafia is the best way to do that, I guess.
You know, you guys, you could join us live over at jblive.tv Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is 4 p.m. Eastern. And we also have an audio stream over at jblive.info if you're on the go or maybe at your desk and they don't want you streaming video. Then you get to hang out in our chat room and ask all kinds of crazy questions to Alan and or suggest crazy conspiracies. Alan, any other thoughts on that story?
No, that's about it. It's just not clear what's causing the problem or how they're getting infected.
I have a feeling we'll eventually find out. Oh,
there's a couple other things in the ESET article. They talked about using your package manager to check the hash of your HTTPD.
Yeah.
Whether that's like using DebSum and with, you know, apt or the RPM minus verify and so on. And someone pointed out that cPanel, which is the most popular hosting control panel,
right,
always compiles its Apache from scratch to get it just how it likes it and to make sure it's the same across no matter what operating system, whether you're using CentOS or something else. And generally because CentOS's package version of Apache is rather old. It's not through the package manager, right? You're compiling Apache as part of, with the cPanel scripts, so you don't have a known good hash to compare to. Right, so if you're just sitting down at a cPanel box with an HTTPD, you can't tell if that's a legit HTTPD or not.
Right.
So that's why it's important when you install, you get the, you know, SHA 256 hash of the binary, and then have something to compare to later.
Right.
And then, you know, that gets in discussions of using apps like Tripwire for intrusion detection. But, you know, if they're getting in there and having root access, they could rootkit it so that Tripwire doesn't find the change to HTTPD, but we'll
I have a feeling eventually we'll figure out at least where a large percentage of these are coming, and then we'll cover it on a story here on the show. It'll eventually become a Circle of Life story on the show. All right, Mr. Alan, why don't we take a pause right here and thank this week's sponsor, GoDaddy.com. GoDaddy are longtime supporters of the TechSnap program, and it's a brand new month, the month of May, so they have a new deal for us. They're actually, it's pretty close to the last deal, just a little bit sweeter. When you're checking out over at GoDaddy.com, use the code TECH249, and you'll get your .com for $2.49. Or I have a suggestion for
isn't,
you.
Isn't that 50 cents cheaper than before?
It is,
to be $2.99.
Yeah.
That's insane.
I know. I think what they did is they bought a bunch of domains back in 2011 with Bitcoin, and they've just been sitting on them, and they're just handing them out now because they just made such a profit. That's my only theory. That's my working theory. But you know what? One of the things GoDaddy has done recently is they have totally revamped their website builder. Now, if you have somebody in your family, or I actually this is going to make me sound like an ass, but I was at a hairstylist. It wasn't actually for me, but I was at the hairstylist, and she wanted a website for her.
Sure, it wasn't for you.
It wasn't. Do I look like I got a haircut? No. But she owns a cottage, and that's where she like she does hair extensions is her specialty. That's right. It's all fake. You caught me. And she wanted a website, so I sent her to GoDaddy.com. They have a totally redone website builder, and what she was really concerned about is all of her clients have smartphones, and she wants to make sure her website works good on the smartphone. You probably know somebody like this, a family member, a friend, that you just want them to get up and running. Send them over to GoDaddy.com. Not only is GoDaddy the world's number one domain name registrar, so you know if you send them there and then they come back to you a year from now with more questions, it's going to be very straightforward to get back in there and get them going. But now that they've got this new website builder, it's great for people that want to set up a site really fast and have it work across both standard resolution displays and mobile devices. The system has a built-in content scanner, and it can make adjustments based on your requirements. It's really fantastic, and it's a great deal, especially if you use the code TECH249. You get the .com for $2.49 or transfer your domain for $2.49. But maybe you want to do something else. You want to take 32% off your purchase while you're over at GoDaddy. Use the code GO32OFF3. GO32OFF3 will get you 32% off of a new purchase. And thank you to GoDaddy. You hear that typing? Right now, that's Alan. Alan's typing a thank you letter to GoDaddy for those great deals.
Yes.
Yeah. He's probably chatting in the chat room because it's been a few seconds since he was talking last. Thanks to GoDaddy for sponsoring the TechSnap program, and thanks to all of you who support the show by supporting our sponsor. All right, Alan. Now, I got my passwords hashed. I got my passwords salted. I never have to worry, ever. And I'm just going to post them online publicly. Right?
Not exactly, no.
What? Yeah. What's going on?
Oh, yeah. Just because a hash is cryptographic hash and it's salted does not mean it's uncrackable, no matter what anyone says.
Aww.
So we've seen a couple of times with these password leaks, like the one at Live Social, you know.
Yes.
They're like, oh, well, we salted the hash password, so you're okay. It's
right.
Like, no, not exactly.
Right. Or there was a, was it OkCupid just happened too?
That was a while ago, I think.
Yeah.
But Reputation.com, they say that their passwords were highly encrypted because they were salted and hashed. And they say, although it's highly unlikely these passwords could ever be decrypted, we recommend you change your password. It's not highly unlikely that the passwords will be cracked. They will definitely be cracked. That's
really?
Just how it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Basically, you should assume every password ever will always be cracked eventually.
Right.
It's just about how long it's going to take.
Yeah.
Right?
That's very true. That's the math of it. It's literally the math of it.
Yes, because all it is math. Yeah. It's hard math, so it takes a while to do,
yeah.
But it's still doable. So we saw, you know, Living Social was a password leak of 50 million password hashes, and details finally came out about what they were using for hashing it and so on. Apparently, Living Social was using an SHA-1 hash with a 40-byte salt, and that's all they really say.
Mm.
So that seems to suggest what they did is take your password, generate a 40-byte random salt, append that to your password, and do an SHA-1 hash of that. And then store the salt somewhere else so they can redo that to verify. The problem with that is that's not very good. And that can be cracked very, very quickly.
Right.
Because you're only doing one SHA-1 hash per attack. No, it's not. Fader in the chat room says one salt, It's like, no, it's one salt per user. And that's all you would normally have. The problem is they're only doing one round of SHA-1. Right. So they're only doing the hash once. SHA-1 and SHA-512 and SHA-3 and so on were designed to be fast, right? They're for hashing files. So you want them to be as fast as possible. So you have to do other things if you want to use them for passwords, because with password hashes, you want them to be slow. But yeah, it seems like they rolled their own password hashing system rather than using a known good one. And so that's why they have... this, right, they knew that just doing an SHA-1 hash of the password was not going to be good enough, right? That's what LinkedIn did, right? They had just an SHA-1 hash, and they got cracked really quickly, because all you have to do is try, guess every possible password, hash it, and then see if that's in the list of hashes. And so basically the problems with their approach is, A, SHA-1 is designed for speed, right? In a cryptographic password hashing system, you want it to be slow and expensive. So speed is not optimal. So, right, so to that end, there are special versions of the SHA algorithms designed for passwords. such as SHA-512 Crypt, which is basically the standard in most Linux distros now and in FreeBSD and so on. Because what it does is instead of just doing, well, first of all, SHA-512 is quite a bit stronger than SHA-1, right? SHA-1 is 160 bits, whereas SHA-512 is 512 bits, meaning there's that many more possible hashes, so that many fewer collisions. Or a collision is when two different things have the same hash. So anyway, rather than just doing an SHA-512 hash on the input, it does a variable number of rounds where it basically takes the password and the salt, hash that, then add to that the salt and hash that, and then add to that the password and hash that, and keep going. The default is 5,000 times. Right? So instead of taking the amount of time it takes to do the SHA-512 operation once, it does it 5,000 times on alternating inputs.
Right.
So that it is purposely to make it as slow as possible. And an important thing is it's adjustable. So one of the parts of the hash before the salt is the number of rounds. The default's 5,000, but you can turn that up as high as you want to make it take longer. And the idea is you adjust it until it takes as long as you can tolerate, basically, right? So it's basically until it's so slow it's noticeable, and then back it off one notch, and then leave it there. Because that means when someone's trying to guess the passwords, they have to spend that amount of time for each guess. So even if they're working with a dictionary with like a million passwords in it,
right,
it's still going to take a million times whatever that number is. If it's, say, a good number is, say, 100 milliseconds. So if you have a million passwords, all of a sudden it's going to take 100,000 seconds to go through that million passwords. But to do the math on that, that's only not even a day and a half. Right? But with the...
not so bad if you're going after one.
If people have longer... if people have longer passwords, it'll take a lot longer.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
And if you're going after 50,000 users versus one user.
Yeah, or 50 million users that all have 11-character passwords, then it'll be a lot.
Yeah.
Take years instead of minutes.
Right. So you can help, in a way, you can help your fellow other community members by having a long password, because maybe the attacker will spend a really long time on your account.
So a couple things that some people didn't know or didn't understand about what a salt is and what it does and why it's there.
Okay.
But just before that, I forgot to mention, there's a link in the article that explains the differences between the original MD5 crypt, which was written by Paul Henningkamp, who's was a FreeBSD kernel developer.
Yeah.
And basically the idea there was do the MD5 100 times to make it slower.
All right.
So one, the biggest difference with the SHA-256 and SHA-512 crypts is that the number of times is variable so that it won't have to be phased out after so many years, right? You can just turn it up instead. But it also goes through the differences, and it kind of explains the system they use so that you're not just doing the hash of the hash of the hash of the hash, because eventually that's going to reduce the key space, right? So it has this alternating inputs so that the hash is unique every time. The purpose of the salt is not to make the hash stronger or anything. It's just to make it more work when you're trying to guess more than one user, right? So if you get a password list from a server, if you're only worried about root, salting the passwords doesn't make it any harder at all, right? If you're after just one account, it doesn't make a difference at all, because basically the salt is right there in the hash, right? Because it's like the algorithm indicator, some options sometimes.
Okay.
The salt and then the hash. Right?
Oh,
because when you try to log in, what the operating system does is look at the hash, be like, all right, I need to use this algorithm with this salt, and then it takes the password you just typed in, puts those into the algorithm, and then gets the output, and then check, is this output identical to what I have written down? If it is, then you typed the right password. If it's not, then you typed the wrong password. So anyway, the salt is right there, and so the salt doesn't make your password any harder to decrypt. All the salt does is make it so that when I'm trying to guess the password, I have to hash it separately for each user in the list with a different salt, right? Because every user has a different salt. That way, I can't just be like, oh, look, these five users have the word password as their password by guessing once, right? If you use, like at LinkedIn, if you just did the SHA-1 hash of their password, any users with the same password would have the same hash. So it would be obvious, oh, look, all of these people have the same password. Or if you're trying to crack passwords in a list, you could just grab all the ones that are, or, you know, the 10 most popular hashes and target them first because, mm-hmm. A, they're probably really simple, and mm-hmm. B, they give you the most accounts.
Right.
So what the salt does is make it so that even if users have the same password, their hashes are completely separate. And basically it makes it more work if you want all the passwords off the list.
Right.
But if you're after just the root login, it doesn't make it any harder at all.
Right, right. That makes sense.
So you should salt your passwords when you're hashing them. But doing it doesn't make them any stronger. It just makes the job of the attacker more difficult if they're trying to get all of the passwords. Right? All it's doing is ensuring that every password is more unique. Paul Hennekamp, the author of the original MD5 crypt, in his post that we talked about last year, where he officially deprecated MD5 crypt because it's not good enough anymore. You shouldn't use it anymore.
Stop it.
MD5 is not good enough. You know, video cards can crack it at rates that are so insane. They were unimaginable when he wrote this in 1995. He recommends that for larger sites, they consider using a blend of different algorithms, right? Rather than just using SHA-512 crypt or bcrypt, they kind of mix some of them together so that if there was a class break against one, or, for example, SHA-512 crypt, there's an open source project that has spent a lot of time tuning their code to make it as fast as possible to crack those on a video card.
Right.
Whereas bcrypt so far has proved to be resistant to cracking on a GPU. It actually takes longer on a GPU than a CPU. Right? And so by blending those, you can ensure if, you know, somebody figured out some way to accelerate bcrypt and crack it really fast, because you would be mixing in the SHA-512 as well, it would still take longer. But basically, it's better to kind of mix together a couple of known good algorithms than to try to write your own, right? Because if you're not a cryptographer, you probably shouldn't be trying to write your own password hashing algorithm.
It sounds typical today.
Specifically, Paul Hennekamp wrote that, you know, I'm declaring MD5 crypt dead, but I'm not writing the new one because I'm not a cryptographer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I think it was kind of just a fluke that I wrote the old one.
Yeah.
It's like I was replacing this little homebrew thing that was even worse. I never expected it to last or, you know, be used on Cisco routers and so on. Although what we saw when Cisco tried to replace MD5 crypt, they screwed up pretty badly.
Yes. Yes.
Remember we talked about that a couple weeks ago too.
Yes, I do. Oh, Alan.
So the most important point is that password hashing was never and will never be uncrackable. Right? It was never the point. Right? It's always going to be possible to brute force it.
Especially when you have so many sites and services where you have a password. I mean, the amount, it's just like the possibility times the amount of accounts you have these days is higher and higher and higher every day. Just up
right,
and up.
But none of that has anything to do with password hashing per se. But
no, but the probability that somebody's going to get it eventually and try to crack it.
The probability that somebody's going to get your hash to try to crack it is way up now.
Yeah.
And, you know, the probability that someone can crack that hash is going down. It's getting more possible for them to do it because people can get a whole bunch of video cards or get access to banks of computers or whatever, you know, botnets and things like that. Basically, hashing the password is just a security measure. As with every security measure, it's a trade-off. The trade-off is balancing the amount of computer power it takes to log in, right, to do a single hash to make sure your password is the right one, versus, you know, you want to make that take as long as possible, just short of the point where, you know, you're sitting there waiting for it to happen, or where it's, you know, because there's 10 users logging in every hour or every minute, you know, 10 users logging in a minute would mean that it would saturate all your CPU cores, right? If each hash took 1 minute to generate, you'd be sitting there for a minute every time you want to log in, and that would be bad. But also multiple users would eventually saturate all the core, right? You have to figure out a scale of somebody that has 50 million users, you might have 100 logins a second, right? So you got to tune that so that you're not using all your CPU time just calculating hashes.
Yeah, and DDoS yourself.
You need to have it take as long as you possibly can bear so that when someone's trying to crack it, it takes them that much longer. Right? The idea is that when you're logging in, calculating your hash takes an imperceptible amount of time, right? Like 50 or 100 milliseconds. But for brute forcing it, because you have to make millions and millions of guesses, it takes an impractical amount of time, right? So to guess all possible 10-character passwords, it would take 20 years. That's the goal. You want it to take much longer than that because you got to figure they're going to use more than one computer, right? So you want it to take thousands of years or millions of years so that even if they have a million computers, it's still going to take 1,000 years or something. But basically, password hashing is designed to buy time, right? It's to give you that time between when the password database got leaked and when they could possibly have cracked your password and try to use it against you. So that when the password gets leaked, you know, you have time to reset your password before they could possibly crack it. Right? With the LinkedIn ones, they had cracked like 60% of the passwords within a couple of days. Right? So there was lots of people who hadn't reset their LinkedIn password yet, and people knew what their password was. Whereas if they'd been using bcrypt, hopefully it would have taken long enough that most people's password wouldn't have been brute forced yet by time they had already gone and reset their password.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea.
So it's just about buying time, right?
Yeah.
It take long enough that everyone has time to reset their password app. You know, you have time to detect that it happened and change your password. Because sometimes you don't detect it right away, right?
Right.
We talked about this before when it happened to Cryptic. It was like 6 or 8 months or more before they found out it happened.
Right.
And they only found out once the attackers had cracked the passwords and were compromising all of these accounts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Once they said, oh, look, we got 1,000 accounts have been compromised. Something's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, and we saw it going on for a while before they really even kind of became aware of it.
Yeah, before the number got big enough for them to figure out, hey, there's a pattern here.
Right.
You know, it's only people whose accounts are older than this amount and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so password hashing is just a way to buy time, right? It's secure. It's, you know, security in depth. You want to have as many layers as possible so that it buys you time. And also, you want to remember to use a unique password for every different site so that when one of them cracks your password, it doesn't give them access to everything.
Jeez, no kidding. We mention it all the time.
The worst example was LinkedIn because your username was your email address, right? A lot of sites have gone to using your email address as your username.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that for a couple of reasons. A, it means that they expose my email address when they necessarily didn't have to.
Yes.
But also, you know, so when you had that LinkedIn password list, the smart thing to do was try that email, go to, you know, find all the Gmail addresses and then try that LinkedIn, people's LinkedIn password against their email account, because I bet half the time it was the same. Right? So that meant you could get in the email account of all of the people who you got their LinkedIn password.
Yep.
Because they use the same password.
That's the reason I don't like it when people use the email address. I mean, I understand why they do it.
Most of the time, the database, even if you use a username, the database has your email address as well. So it's not that big of a deal. Yeah. It's just very important you never use your email password for anything else, ever.
Right, right. And go use LastPass. Just knock it off already. Yep. Or go use KeePass. If you're not going to use LastPass, go use KeePass. But just do me a favor and use one of them right now. Just knock it off. Just this weekend, set aside 45 minutes on Saturday. And if you haven't done this yet, do it. This is, and I'm not even kidding, this is like, you know those people who use, you know those people who didn't know how to use computers that also didn't use antivirus and got viruses all the time and they still do? Well, now you have all these people that don't know how to run websites, running websites, and you gave them the keys. And if you don't take the precautions to protect yourself, that's on you. And so you need to go use services like LastPass or KeePass or whatever it is. But just have a unique password for every site that's damn good.
Yeah, like an analogy just popped in my head based on what you said. It's like you know, making copies of the keys to your house and giving them to people.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it's the key that opens your email and your Facebook and your bank account.
And I would,
right? If it's the password that opens your bank account,
yeah,
and you give it to
the babysitter,
Facebook,
the babysitter,
or
in this analogy, you give it to a teenager who maybe might be very trustworthy, but also could end up not being trustworthy. You just don't know because they're, you know, teenagers.
Yeah. And so basically, when you reuse the same password, you're giving all of the sites access to all of each other. So if you use the same password for Facebook, your bank, and that dodgy forum run by some guy,
right?
Then the dodgy guy from the forum now has access to your bank account.
Yep.
And don't like,
I don't know, Jetta says in the chat room, if you really want to step up to the big leagues, when possible, turn on two-factor. And you know, there's nothing
that little forum's not going to have two-factor.
Right. No, whenever possible. And there it is a nice little safety net.
Yeah.
All right, Alan, any other thoughts on that?
Even with two-factor, you still need to use a different password, right? You can't reuse the same password and then have two-factor.
Right.
That will protect the sites with two-factor, but it doesn't protect everybody.
Assume the two-factor is perfect. The systems might not always be perfect either.
We've talked about that. Even Google's one, right? There was, problems with the two-factor on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to try these things out because these are solutions that the rest of the technology community, even the people who are kind of at the end of the bell curve, are going to eventually have to start adopting, or we're going to have to replace the password system with something that nobody's really been able to propose yet. So now it seems like it's a good time to get this stuff figured out if you haven't done it yet.
Yep.
Anything else we want to cover on that story?
No.
Okay. Before we go, I just wanted to make a mention. I got Star Trek The Next Generation Season 3 on Blu-ray this week, and this is a good point to remind folks that if you would like to support the Jupiter Broadcasting Network, a large portion of how we stay on the air and are funded is by our listener contributions. Now, you can donate directly. We also have affiliate links at the bottom of our website for Amazon and Netflix and Newegg and ThinkGeek and Best Buy. If you go through the Amazon one, go check out the new Star Trek Season 3 on Blu-ray. It is absolutely stunning. I mean, give you goosebumps. The ships look incredible. The sets look amazing. Season 3 also, they really, Star Trek Next Generation kind of got in its
groove. That's when Next Generation took off.
Yeah. And they... it looks so good. And it's not just like the fact that they've redone the visual effects in a way that look very, they hold up very well. They look like they could be from there, but they're pop and they're crisp, and they've redone the sound. It's incredible. And if you want to grab it, I'll put a link in the show notes if I remember. And if you pick it up through our link in the show notes, you will support the Jupiter Broadcasting Network. I got it. It is incredible. It is amazing. It's been the perfect thing because I've been a little sick. So when you're sick and I just want to lay on the couch, I've been watching it and I am just absolutely floored. So I wanted to make that recommendation to you guys. But Mr. Jude, with the news all done, I think that means it's time for the TechSnap feedback. Thanks for sending your emails to techsnap@jupiterbroadcasting.com or popping that contact link at the top of our website or starting a thread in our subreddit. And I really appreciate it when you do the thread in the subreddit over at links.techsnap.tv. Our first email, Alan, comes from Jason, and here it is. He writes in with actually a couple of suggestions. First of all, we had a few people that wrote about the generator, so we're going to cover a few of those. Last week, we asked about somebody who wanted to know when a generator kicked off. He says, for generator monitoring, a former employer of mine had a generator outside that started itself up and tested every Saturday at 9 a.m. The only way we could monitor it back then was to have an operator walk outside to hear if it turned on. These days, I just hook a small PC, maybe a Raspberry Pi, to an external AC plug, set the SD card as read-only to avoid file system corruption, and have it start scripts and send an email or alert. Oh, I suppose if it just powered on when it got power, it could
do that.
Yeah,
so basically it's a device that powers on when the generator kicks on, which causes it to send an email, and then it just gets powered off when the generator turns off.
Yep.
That's one way to do it. I think what the guy was looking for is basically that, except for in a tiny little micro device like a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you could. You could do it with a Pi.
Yep.
He also wrote in. We had a few people that wrote in this week on how they, because I complained that my Fios ActionTech router, my connection from my fiber box is in my garage, and then in my master bedroom, which is on totally at the other end of the house upstairs, is connected via coax. So I can't just take the Ethernet out of the back of my ActionTech and like plug into a pfSense box. A few people wrote in. A couple of people use a ActionTech converter. I'm not quite sure on how they use that. It looked pretty interesting. So I got to look into that because if it works properly, it looks like I could take this ActionTech converter box and maybe get Ethernet, maybe take my coax into this and get Ethernet out and plug that into. I mean, it looks like it's designed to run. It looks like it's designed to extend an Ethernet network over coax, is what this box does.
But apparently it uses the same protocol that Verizon does to deliver your Fios over coax. So if you hooked it up instead of the modem, it would convert the FiOS, the coax FiOS signal back into Ethernet.
That could be freaking awesome.
Yeah.
And it's only like $60.
Yeah.
So I got to try this. This is what I got to do. I got to try this.
Yep.
And then I got to pick a pfSense box. So then one more thing that Jason wanted to touch on before he ran was he said... he also had a tip for Shelby, who was looking for intern-like experience to build up his IT knowledge as he prepares to transition from the military. He says, go to a LUG meeting and see who wants help. That's not a bad idea.
For people that don't know, LUG would be Linux Users Group.
Yeah.
There's also a Unix Users Group and things like that. So, yeah, if you go to those type of places, there's lots of people that are working on hobby-type projects and open-source projects and lots
Need
of things
volunteers.
Like that.
Yep.
And, yeah, they're always looking for people that want to learn.
He had a question that I don't know if we have an answer for, Alan. It's basically it boils down to he's trying to get OpenCL working under FreeBSD. Is that a thing right now? Do you know if that works?
Basically, FreeBSD only has good drivers for NVIDIA GPUs, which are not good for
Litecoin mining. Yeah.
Bitcoin to Litecoin. So yeah. When I built my box, it was the only time I've ever used Ubuntu.
And I think it hurt him a little bit because he still mentions it to this day.
Yeah. I scrapped that machine and
burned it.
It runs Windows now.
Oh, ouch.
It belongs to some other person.
Oh, wow.
I sold it.
Wow. You had to get you had to get it out of your life, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No more Ubuntu, thanks.
Lego Maniac writes in, he says, we use a device from AKCP called a sensor probe. This is his suggestion for monitoring the generator. Mm-hmm. He says, this is a small box that looks like an 8-port switch or router, but instead of plugging into network components, you plug in their line of smart sensors. All these sensors use standard Cat5, so you can put in the main box in the server room. That's nice. And the sensors anywhere else, you have a run of Cat5. They make sensors for temperatures, humidity, water levels, AC line, voltage, even dry contact sensors. Ding, 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 ding. But the best part, all the sensor data is exposed via SNMP. We have our nachos hooked up to two of these units, plus when combined with a service called PagerDuty, will get a voice call if the power ever goes out in the buildings or a temperature in a server room goes up past a threshold. All in all, a very low-cost solution for some very sophisticated capabilities. Keep up the good work, Lego Maniac. Very cool. I you know, we had a couple of people write in who mentioned the dry loop thing, and I think that's the dry contact. I'm sorry. I think that's probably it. There's one more from Ken. Ken says, generator dry closure. Here we go, dry closure, that's what it was. Depending on how much access you have, the transfer panel will usually have a dry closure for which position in it, for which position is in, either utility or genset. There are some relatively inexpensive remote control systems that can make closures and alert via the phone or email. They would probably be overkill for one input, but I'm sure people can find other things to monitor as well. And he includes some links if you want to check that out. So very cool, man. So there's some suggestions for if you want to monitor a generator, and people had a lot of ways they did that. All right, back to the FiOS and pfSense topic. Chris, I heard your comment about a project for pfSense and FiOS. I have done that in my house, and he includes a link to a forum post he has on DSL Reports. He also used this ActionTech converter. He said the biggest complexity was bridging the Verizon interface that the WAN port on the pfSense took on the correct IP address. I got a NearAware VO processor box rigged up as my pfSense rig, and it works great.
Someone from the chat room, CTC Wired, mentioned that apparently, depending on which Verizon modem you have, in the newer ones, you can just call Verizon and tell them you have, you know, your own fancy router, and they can just make some changes, and the Ethernet port on the Verizon box will just pass through to your pfSense.
That would be surprisingly simple and easy. It's not a new one, but maybe it's new enough. I don't know. All right.
Basically, some of the old ones apparently had an Ethernet port, but it didn't do anything. But on the newer ones, does.
Very good. All right. Chris writes in. He says, hey, guys, I want to pose a ZFS question to Alan. Is it possible to replace a failed drive with two mirrored drives? Here's a breakdown to clarify. He's got six drives in RAID Z2, and then one drive fails. Two drives are mirrored, and he wants to replace a failed drive. He says, I haven't had a drive failure yet, thankfully. When that does happen, though, I would like to know what my options are. So what do you think? Okay, so what now?
So he has a RAID Z2 that has six drives. One of the drives has failed, and he wants to replace one drive with a mirror set?
I think so, yes.
No, that doesn't work. You can't do that. Or could you? I don't think you can do that. And you wouldn't want to anyway.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm not sure why you would try to do that.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to trade space for speed, like read speed, by doing mirroring, you would just set up sets of mirrors, right? If you have six drives, you'd have three two-disk mirrors, and you would stripe across those automatically.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he's just trying to, for an intellectual. I guess he's just trying to...
Yeah.
Maybe he doesn't want to break the mirror that he has.
Well, he doesn't. Well, it seems like he doesn't have a mirror. He has the six-drive RAID Z2.
Yeah.
One of the drives failed, and he wants to replace that one drive with two drives, which doesn't really make any sense.
No, so don't do it. Don't do it. Abort. Don't do it.
There is no... the people in the chat room are confused, too. There is no mirrored set from the way I read this email.
Yeah, I don't know. You want me to read it again?
Basically, when one drive fails, you pull out that drive and put in a second. Because it's RAID Z2, there's enough redundancy there, so even if two of the six drives die, all of your data is still readable, and you can just pull out the dead drive, put in the new ones, and do the ZFS replace command.
Is it possible to replace a failed drive with two mirrored drives?
Yeah, so basically he wants to replace the one VDEV with two devices as a mirror acting as a single VDEV. And that might actually be possible. I've never tried it, and I wouldn't recommend doing that.
There you go. The Jude has spoken. Don't do it. That would be probably pretty safe advice. All right. Very good. I want to talk about something I've never heard about before, but it was sent in to us by Tim, a.k.a. JB Fanboy in the IRC. He says, let's talk mail servers. I know you mentioned on TechSnap about the challenges of building an email server from scratch. Have we? That doesn't actually sound like something we've actually talked about.
Well, a little bit. Like, we could have an interview with my business partner who set up our setup, which is like a postfix with Dovecot, and it does domain keys signing and a bunch
very
of other
nice,
crazy
dudes. Well, Tim wants us to know about something called iRedMail, or something. I think that's how you'd say it. He says he's been using it for the past year to deploy mail servers. It's a script that quickly installs needed components for a mail server, Dovecot, postfix, some antivirus, and gives you a choice of MySQL, OpenLDAP, Postgres backends. And it works on many Linux distros, FreeBSD, and OpenBSD. But wait, there's more! To top all that off, it comes with a slick admin interface for easy administration. And he sent us in some links. He says, I hope you have time to check out this great project and mention it on the show. I've always mixed...
I never like scripts that install a bunch of stuff for me.
Here's what I say. I say...
Especially when it's doing it from scratch. It's like, I prefer the FreeBSD ports tree and then configure it myself.
You know, if you're comfortable auditing the configuration, then that's one thing. And it's also good for learning.
If it's doing multiple operating systems and basically it's compiling the mail server from scratch or something rather than using the native package manager...
Oh, no, I'm sure it's just pulling down.
It gets... Yeah, if it's just pulling down the tar files and compiling them, you know, that's the way I used to do stuff before I learned better. Because upgrading in that type of situation is a mess.
Yeah.
Basically, you lose what FreeBSD does with its package management, where it keeps track of every file that it installed, and when you uninstall them, there's nothing left except for files you modified yourself. So, like, you can uninstall postfix, and any file that's still has the same SHA 256 hash as when you install it gets deleted, and any file that doesn't. So specifically, your config file stays, and everything else gets deleted. And then you install the newer version, and it installs a new stock config file to a different file name, and you can diff the two and fix up your config, and you're good to go. And there's notes every time there's a major change, right? There's a big file in the port tree called updating that warns you of anything you need to watch out for when you're updating.
I think I could see using this. So the scenario would be something like, I want to roll into some place, maybe throw a VM up on their network and get them a mail server. And it does have that web administration front end. So maybe then you could step out and the office manager could add and remove mail accounts for people. I mean, there's some niceties to that there. And, I suppose if there's a lot of due diligence taken to make sure that it's configuring things securely, just probably before you put it into an important production environment, whenever something's automated like this, you'd always want to experiment in a virtual machine or something like that. I had a long time
mostly
ago.
Mostly my concern with that type of setup is how you upgrade it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I had a long time ago, it was on a Mandrake box back when there was a Mandrake Enterprise server, and it had like this script process you would run through, and it would set up a bunch of stuff. And one of them is it would join you to a Windows domain, and then it would configure even all of the terminal logins at the console and everything to authenticate against a Windows domain. And man, was that awesome until I did a system upgrade and it broke something. I don't remember what it was. And then I couldn't log into the box at all. And one of the things I discovered is the script put the order of authentication stuff in the wrong order. And if it would have done local users first, I would have been able to log in even though I couldn't talk to the domain. But because the script authors just decided to flip those two things, I was stranded from my machine until I rebooted into single user mode. So, you know, yeah, there can be very small nuances that automatic scripts do differently than you might if you set it all up from scratch. But it's a good way to learn and, you know, walk it back and see what they're doing. So, cool. Thanks for sending it in too, Tim. It's very, very interesting to look at.
People might find that useful. It's just my concern is when it's time to upgrade all that software, if it's not through the package system,
He includes links to a demo, a YouTube video tutorial, and their website. Just look for Tim's Really Likes iReadmail, a link in the show notes. All right, Alan, our last email for the day comes from Super Nathan with some troubles in South Korea. He says, first of all, loves the show, says we do a great job all. Thanks, Super Nathan. He says, I'm a middle school English teacher from South Korea. One of the best parts of my job is that the school doesn't care what I do with my computer as long as it freaking works. It's got XP on there, so he's reloaded it with Linux. I guess they're okay with that. He's been using Crunchbang, and he has a five-year-old machine that he also runs Minecraft on. Here's a problem, Alan. He's got this laptop, and Windows networking worked fine under the laptop. He says, goes on to say that, however, when trying to do a net install or command line setup for something like PCBSD, he's not getting out to the web, and he talked to their networking person, and they gave him this address. It's a 192.168.72.213 address. However, the gateway is a 192.168.70.1, and he's in a 255.255.255.0. So he's got a different, his router's in a different subnet.
That NetMask isn't right then.
Right.
Basically.
So she's, and he says that he's unable to go to her for questions. So he wanted to know if this looked wrong to us. And yes, the NetMask is wrong.
Yes.
You might try 255.255.0.0.
If you can boot it in Windows and get DHCP and see, like, it mostly has DHCP, right? So the FreeBSD DHCP should just work.
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, maybe they're giving them statics. Yeah, it's a static IP, maybe. He says. Yeah, it's a static IP.
Well, if it is static, basically, look at a machine that's working and see what its NetMask is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's your NetMask. There you go, right there. Boom.
Yeah. Most people just assume 255.255.255.0 is always right, and it's not.
Oh, he says here, he says that same arrangement does work under Crunchbang, which seems odd. I went to the IRC chat room, and people told me that the NetMask is wrong. Oh, okay, well, there we go. we discovered that if I hijacked a printer's IP of 192.168.70.20, that I got internet. But for obvious reasons, I can't use that IP. I can't ask the network lady for help. So I was hoping you guys could shed some light. Well,
basically, widen the subnet mask.
Yeah, try 255.255.0.0 and then see if you can get out with a .72 address.
Yeah, that should work. Basically, it's better if you have the right one, because right now, trying to get to other subnets within that /16 would not work if you have the wrong. So if you make your subnet mask too wide, there's a bunch of networks that should go through a router that won't try to go through the router, and it'll be wrong. But yeah,
that's a, you know, he says that he runs into an issue of not only of cultural differences and language differences too, and they're just, you know, essentially unable to really help him. And you know, you'd say go look it up, but if you don't have internet connectivity, that can be tough. All right, if you want to email the show, do so, techsnap@jupiterbroadcasting.com, or hit our contact link and choose TechSnap from the dropdown, or my favorite, start a thread in our subreddit over at links.techsnap.tv, and you save me some copy and paste. But Mr. Jude, with all of the feedback done, that must mean it's time for the TechSnap Roundup! Welcome to the TechSnap Roundup. Yeah, that's what that crazy music means. Now, the Roundup are stories that didn't quite fit at the very top of the show, but we still want to talk about them, maybe give you some links to follow up on your own. And a lot of these links are provided by our subreddit over at links.techsnap.tv. All right, Alan. By that typing, I'm gauging you are ready for our first Roundup story. And
it's your story, so
I know.
Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to be trendy and talk about Google Glass because everybody else is. As you might expect, Google Glass has been jailbroken. Now, it's actually, I believe, based on Android 404 or 401 or something. It's an older version of Android. So right. There's some well-known vulnerabilities that are actually very quick to exploit if you have physical access to the device. So if you could grab somebody's glass, you could actually do this. few of the things they could do was adjust recording time, install third-party apps, and this one's fun. Disable all visual indications that Glass is recording. That was just... Can't wait for malware to figure that one out. Anyways, that's obviously me playing the fear-mongering card because, of course, any new kind of technology like this is going to have that. And I'm sure before they get it out, they'll have it all patched up and ready to go. I guess internally at Google, there's been a lot of debate in the terms of design on how to physically secure the device. And I guess right now, from what reports are saying, is they're kind of erring on the side of caution. Like, they're not integrating in, like, a PIN code system before you get access to the Glass interface or anything like that. So, because they feel like it's a usability barrier. But, well, I wonder if maybe they'll walk back on that line a little bit as Glass reaches market. All right, that's all I had. You can read more in the show notes. It's actually a two-part piece by one of the guys who did the jailbreaking himself. This one was just kind of interesting from they do that kind of perspective. Mozilla is upset because government agencies are buying a piece of software from a firm.
A piece of malware. It's basically spyware.
That is that's branded as Firefox.
Yeah, so basically this spyware company makes their spyware look and say that it's Firefox.
It's even called Firefox.exe.
Users will run it.
Yeah.
And not be suspicious of it. And so
in the credits, it thanks the Mozilla developers. And, I mean, it's like verbatim.
Yeah, basically it's Firefox and then modified. And so Mozilla is doing it because of their trademark on the name Firefox. And so on, they're like, no, you can't do that. And it's nice to see Mozilla, you know, actually using the trademark for good.
The action was follows a report by Citizens Lab where they identified 36 countries, including the United States, hosting command and control servers for FinFisher, the type of surveillance software that's built into this executable.
Yep.
Hmm.
It's heavily used in the Middle East to track dissidents as well.
Well, there you go. All right, this one brought a tear to my eye, Alan. ButterFS was a web host that took on a ButterFS experiment.
Yes, a web host called anchor.com.au. Obviously Australian.
Yeah, I heard about this.
They decided, let's try out BTRFS and see what we think.
In general, ButterFS has been a very positive experience, they say, but we're looking to get dedup support in the future, something ZFS already does.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any major takeaway from it? How'd it go?
Basically, they found a bunch of problems, like the system would IO hang if you were trying to read files while you were trying to take a snapshot.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And a bunch of other problems that would cause the whole system to hang, basically.
CPU soft locked up basically became unrecoverable, so we were forced to reboot the system.
And just a bunch of stuff you don't want your file system to do.
The final lesson we learned is you never, ever want to fill up a ButterFS file system. Normal file systems behave fairly predictably when they fill up to close capacity. Your system might behave erratically, but it's large enough you can easily fix it. In the one instance we filled up ButterFS file system due to some misplaced rsync options, it slowed everything down to the point of being unusable. It wasn't practical to diagnose the exact reason for the slowdown, but suffice to say, if you can't even navigate the file system to fix the error, it's a pretty big problem. Yeah. Ouch! Oh, Linux, you need to get a better file system. This one's great, though. Australians working on a mandatory data breach notification bill. Australians' plans for data breach notification scheme have been revealed, which force organizations to report serious breaches.
Yeah, so basically, if there's a serious breach, it forces the companies to have to tell people, because sometimes now they don't really have to. Like in Canada, there's a similar law that forces them to have to tell you if they violate your privacy and so on. But this one spells it out a little more and has fines for companies that don't do it properly or who are negligent in causing the breach.
We have a little follow-up to the whole Spam House, yeah, where they had that massive DDoS event going on. I guess somebody's actually gotten arrested over it, right?
Yes. So the owner of Cyberbunker was hiding or something in Spain and was got arrested.
Oh, ouch. Well, there you go, Sven. There you go. All right. Next story in the roundup. The real reason ARM's going to become a menace in the data center. This story fascinated the pants off of me.
Because the biggest one was the possibility that this will actually happen.
Yeah, because...
I've been hearing about this since AMD talked about it.
Yeah.
Like 10 years ago.
No, but now it sounds like Facebook's working with HP and guys from ARM to build ARM-based server appliances or whatever you want to call it.
Sorry, Facebook clarified that they're not really involved in this project. Okay. Just someone they hired did this research as his PhD when he was in school.
So this is essentially using ARM chips to build a Memcache-specialized device. So the thing only runs Memcached, and it's got a chip. It's an ARM chip, like a cell phone chip.
Yeah, basically, it's like a cell phone processor. Like, the biggest difference between ARM and, like, an Intel is that the company ARM licenses their design out and lets people make their own version of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas Intel doesn't. So in this case, the company, like, for example, the ARM processor in an Apple iPhone, about 50% of the size of the processor is made up of accelerators that they wrote to make certain workloads faster on the iPhone, like the most common type of workloads on the iPhone.
Yeah.
It's not that CPU is necessarily that fast. It just has specific accelerators for certain workloads. So in the general idea here would be make an ARM chip that was just really good at running Memcache, and then we could just make these little low-power boxes just full of RAM, and they would be giant, fast, low-latency memory network storage, basically a memory NAS.
And what's awesome is they already have a proof of concept built and simulated. Like, they've ran it through a simulator and shown it to work, which I think is really cool. And one of the things they said, they tried this on Xeons, but the power cost was way too high. They tried this on Atoms, but the Atom processor just is not capable to read something from memory and then push it out over the network interface fast enough. But these ARM chips...
The older Atom chips can't address enough memory to be useful.
Oh, yeah, good point. Of course. Yeah, but with these ARM chips, they can build in these accelerators so it moves from memory to the network interface as absolutely fast as possible. And I think this is a brilliant idea. And you know, people have dedicated big old powerful servers to do this right now.
Yep.
And this is going to.
And you know, I remember when AMD talked about this like 10 years ago. They were like, you know, we could make a CPU that was accelerated for Java workloads because that was a big thing then.
Yeah.
Or like one that was really good at just parsing XML, which for a lot of businesses that's a big thing they do, right?
Next story sure has me upset. I ranted a little bit last night in Unfilter, but I can't even believe it. You know, CISPA made it through the House, but then hit the floor on the Senate and died. Citing privacy concerns. Well, now there's a new approach.
But see, what they're going to do is break it up into tiny little pieces and then try to push all of them through such that you can't complain about all of them.
This new national security draft will fine tech companies for non-compliance on wiretapping. And it's beautiful. What it basically says is the federal government can come to you at any time, an ISP or whatever, and ask you for records. You just, you know what, CISPA can't get passed, so we're not going to tell you how to do it. You just better get it done. And if you don't get it done, we're going to fine you, and you're going to have legal action taken against you for not providing us the information. So what it essentially does is it puts the entire onus on the company to develop all of the internal processes to deliver all of their customers' information to the government when they want it. Now, you could argue that is actually a little bit better of a system because it lets people customize it for their environment. They can put the logging in and the metrics how they need to for their technology.
Right, but it's very broad. Like, they're not talking about being able to wiretap Skype. They're like, they already want that. That's obvious. But they want to be able to, like, see your Twitter comments in real time or be able to just see any conversation you're having. So are they talking about being able to wiretap IRC?
They want to be able to be in the FBI office and say... They want to literally be able to, they drew an analogy to a phone switch. They want to be able to plug in to your circuit and watch your Skype conversation in real time and then unplug. They don't want to ever have to go to the ISP's closet. They don't want to have to go to your house. They want to have all of this routed somehow into some central point in their office. It sounds like something insane from a movie. And could you imagine the cost of building a system like that?
It would have to almost be at the end, but right? They finally figured out that they can't go to your ISP to wiretap text conversations you're having over Facebook with other people because you're connecting to Facebook over SSL, so the ISP can't see the traffic. They have to go to Facebook.
Right.
And they're worried about, you know, not Facebook. The Facebook they can bully into complying.
Right.
But they're talking about, you know, the 100 little clones of Facebook that people use, right? If you're a terrorist and you're trying to hide, you're going to use, you know, friend book or, you know, some little knockoff or something.
Or like the CIA people who were in Libya during the consulate attack, they were chatting with their handlers via Eve online during the attack. So they want to be able to go to everybody like that and say, all right, we're going to flip the switch, and now we're monitoring your service. And they want it to be built into the technology. It's, wow.
So, yeah, they want to – all technology ever built after this will have to have wiretapping built into it.
It's and if you don't comply, you get fined and legal action.
Yeah, so the EFF is like – so they should rename the bill the Killing American Jobs and Innovation Bill.
Wow.
Because, you know, if you're a tech company, maybe what you should do is move to Canada where we don't have stupid laws like this, and then you could write your software without a wiretapping loophole in it.
Oh, you know, that is true. Maybe businesses would go outside the states, huh? I don't know.
It's the easiest way.
Yeah. Well, and it's what's crazy is all this is driven by the FBI, and I think we talked about it earlier in the year. The FBI came out publicly and said internet surveillance is their number one priority for the year, getting a handle on that. And, you know, in the wake of the Boston bombing, I played about 10 minutes of it on Unfilter last night, and then about another 10 minutes on the pre-show of extra clips, 20 minutes of news clips where they're blaming the internet for radicalizing these guys. And that's coming from what the officials are saying. So they're pinning the Boston bombing on internet radicalization. Never mind that – I don't want to get into politics, but never mind that the brother went to Russia. They're not even – mentioning that, they're just, you know, he got radicalized on the internet. And so then the FBI can say, well, look, we have domestic terrorism. And I know I'm putting on a hat here, but think about it, people. Think critically about this. They can say, look, we have an example of people radicalizing on the internet. We have justification for this. We need to do this. And this is what's happening, it seems to me. And we shoot down SOPA, and then we have something else. Then we shoot that down, then we have something else. Then we shoot down CISPA, or somebody shoots down CISPA, and now we have this. And it just never is going to stop. Good times. We have another story we should end on, right? That's not our ending story, right?
No, okay. We have one more.
Okay, good, because that's a bummer. All right, what is our last story here?
Advertising companies, right? There's been a lot of talk about opting out of being tracked on the web and so on.
Yeah.
But it turns out the advertising companies can't even tell if they're tracking you or who's tracking you. Basically, you know, when you go to Sears.com, you can end up being tracked by a site that does online gambling or something because that ad network has an alliance with this ad network, and you know, then the ads are underperforming, so they're backfilling from a different network, and so they don't really have control over. Nobody knows who's tracking who.
Well, good. That wasn't exactly the sparkling ending I was looking for.
They're trying to go with the self-enforcement system. So the government doesn't mandate that all advertising networks have some way for you to opt out of being tracked. They're saying, we'll write our own opt-out system. You don't have to make a law, whatever. And then now it turns out that they can't even tell if they're tracking you or if some affiliate that they're using is tracking you, even though, right? So if I opt out of being tracked by a big advertising company, but a big advertising company sells some of its leftover ad delivery inventory to some smaller company.
Right.
They don't have a way to make sure that smaller company isn't tracking me too.
Right. Yeah, because once they hand it off, it's not their business anymore.
And basically, it's a lot of these advertising companies don't deliver any of their own. They're just selling to a bunch of other places.
Does advertising tracking bother you? I mean, is that something you worry about?
Me? No. But
I don't either. I don't know
that's
why.
Just me.
I don't really. I guess I feel like it's a – I mean, it depends what they're tracking. Like, there's obviously a line they could cross, and then I'm no longer okay with it. But as long as they're collecting – semi-anonymous. I don't even care how anonymous it is, really. But
yeah, it comes down to they can't get any real information unless somebody who I've given that information to turns it over.
Right.
Right. Like they can't get my real name from tracking cookies unless some website that I've logged into and entered my real name tells them, "Hey, this cookie belongs to this user." So really, it's not necessarily the advertising network. I already don't trust them.
Right, exactly.
It would be, you know, if some business I did business with
sold
my information to the advertising agency with the bit they need to track it or link it to my other information.
Yeah, that's the thing. All right. Well, Mr. Dude, I think that's the whole show, isn't it? Golly, episode 108 in the can. And now don't forget, we love it when you join us live over at jblive.tv. At 1 p.m. Pacific, which is
4 p.m. Eastern, 2000 UTC.
Boom, over at jblive.tv or jblive.info. Then you can download the show after the fact on demand over at jupiterbroadcasting.com, as well as copious links to everything Alan covered. Mr. Jude, thank you for the great show. And, of course, thank you, everyone, for tuning in this week's episode of TechSnap. And we'll see you right back here next week.